You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we don't need no water, let the motherfucker burn. I'm your host, Justin Amosneski, and if you know that reference, or if you just generally like that reference because we're recording this episode on Easter Sunday and it has weird anti-religious subtext, then you belong here in the midside. So happy belated Zombie Jesus Day to you all. Let's get on with it. Joining me this trip, not Daniel T. Richards, because he is again out on paternity leave. I honestly don't know what he's doing, but at this point, I just say he's on paternity
is
leave.
Is there a wedding somewhere that needed officiating? Maybe everyone's busy because of the church, the Notre Dame being on fire, so he had an emergency wedding to officiate.
Is he allowed to officiate Catholic weddings?
Well, it's special circumstances, you know?
That's fair. That's fair. And as you've already heard from Dale's lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. It's exciting times here in Dale's lawn. If you guys are on Discord, you saw the sign, the lighted sign went up on the side of the building at the restaurant. And so it's really happening. It's first real external evidence that there's going to be something there other than a blank shell. So very exciting.
I believe that was in the Patreon only channel on Discord, was it not?
It was. Ooh, and the funny thing is they went to put up the sign, and as soon as they got there, it's like these two guys, and they literally just have to climb up like a 20-foot ladder and just put it up there. You know, they have to carry this sign up. And as soon as they get there, it starts sprinkling. Now, in California, the Californians call this rain, but it was just sprinkling. But I'm just like laughing because it's like, of the 10 days of year that it, you know, that actual liquid falls from the sky in California, one of those days is the day they're putting up the sign. And then, irony of ironies, they get up there, they're starting to screw it in, and it's a high-rise building. That day was also power washing the side of the building day. So, like, water was spraying down from the, like, 20th floor as they're, like, power washing the windows. It was hilarious.
I'm surprised they didn't just stop the second, like, a couple raindrops hit them. They're like, we're gonna take the day off, mister.
No, they got it up there. They got it up there.
Well, I look forward to hearing more stories about what you learned and reflected on during this process in life on the midside. But right now, as we've already alluded to, there's been some pretty crazy farce this week, so we need to get into it in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad.
Line Paris from the Washington Post. Billionaires race to pledge money to rebuild Notre Dame. Then came the backlash. Could it go any other way, Justin? The eventual reconstruction of Notre Dame is now a foregone conclusion. Within hours of the fire that destroyed much of the cathedral on Monday, donors pledged more than $1 billion, that's billion, to restore the Parisian icon to its former glory. Even before the smoke had cleared, luxury goods magnate, some name I can't pronounce, announced his family would donate 100 million euros to the effort. Notch remained on the sidelines. His rivals also donated. It lists on and on, all these donations. But in the meantime, the cascade of cash that materialized overnight to save the cathedral has raised eyebrows in France, and probably cigarettes too. Still in the throes of a crippling protest over rising social inequality, and whose leader is regularly decried as the president of the rich. Of course I find it nice, this solidarity, said Ingrid, a leader of the Yellow Vest movement that has protested inequality in a series of often violent Saturday demonstrations since mid-November. The stream of donations essentially confirmed the movement's broader social critique. If they can give tens of millions to rebuild Notre Dame, then they should stop telling us that there's no money to help with social emergency. So, Justin, is this looking a gift horse in the mouth, or is this just the French being French?
False dichotomy, bro. You set that one up really well. I mean, that's what the French do. My favorite part about this article, though, is as you keep reading it, it doesn't even flow narratively. It just becomes a greatest hits of complaints of the left. Like, at one point, they even said white privilege in there, didn't it? The fact that people would support Notre Dame over other crises in the world.
I was going to comment on that. In privilege. 6 months, just 50 million euros has been pledged to restore Brazil's National Museum. I think this is what they call white privilege.
Right. Okay. And this is my question. Okay. Now, granted, I didn't grow up in these non-white places or whatever. I grew up in the U.S. and I do have French heritage.
Wait, but the U.S. is a white place? I'm going to challenge you on that one.
Okay. You understand the point I'm making. That's from their point of view, right? From their point of view, the U.S. is a white place. Okay. That's what I was referring to. I don't believe any place is a white place. I don't believe any place is a black place. I believe there are people with certain skin tones, but those places are not. This is the second story. Stop making me talk about the second story already. Jesus. Which is the best part. Also, this whole episode, right? This whole episode is like a greatest hits almost of social justice in the left. It's really amusing. But no, you know, I grew up in the U.S. I have French heritage. I am, in fact, white. But if you compare the Brazilian National Museum to Notre Dame, which is more known around the world and which is more of a cultural artifact? Is that my white privilege speaking? Well, or can you not comment on this because you also have white privilege? Like, what do we do here? Because to me, it's like really obvious Notre Dame is more important.
Well, I think that since I do check my white male gay privilege, I can talk about this freely. The problem here is tribalism. I think I'm going to repeat myself four times during the news segment.
What do you mean? You repeat yourself every episode.
The problem here is tribalism. The reason why this is a bad, like, integrated thought is that you left off an implicit statement there. It's more important to you. It's more important to the people here that are giving the money. Why are we judging these folks for valuing something? It seems wrong, right? You're trying to take their group identity and use it against them because they value something. These people clearly value this icon. It's an icon to them. If people value the cultural artifacts in Syria and want to rebuild them, then that's great. I'm not going to give them shit or tell them they should instead donate to the cathedral at Notre Dame.
Right. And what you're saying is we don't always go in this direction on the show, which is very intentional on my part. I wanted sort of a more concrete based show and a less philosophical show. But what you're saying and this article really demonstrate the link between tribalism / collectivism, as you say every week, William, with altruism. And the way it does that is, you know, altruism is the idea that you're supposed to do things that are against your own self-interest, to be selfless in order to be moral, to be a good person.
Yeah. Well, this selfless, is a not in the newfound glory song sense.
Well, let's not deal with that issue. That's a different thing. That's also, you know, the difference between selfishness and narcissism, right? Right. Most people, when they're saying selfishness, they really mean narcissism. That's a whole other episode. Maybe we can do a special mid-side episode on these more abstract thoughts. But here, it's so concretely grounded. They're literally giving to a religious cause, which is supposed to be altruistic. But it's not really a religious cause now because we're seeing that in order to be truly selfless, you have to be collectivist. Now, let me reverse that. Collectivism necessarily leads to being selfless because what you have here is the group is what's more important. So you're going to do things that the group wants, not what you want. The fact of even thinking individually and having individual values is the problem here. The fact that these people even possess this wealth and would decide what to do with it on their own. The only way these people would ever be happy is if these people turned over their bank accounts and just said, here, you guys manage my money and you decide what to do with it. Then they would say they were good people. But even then they would say, oh, they're not good people. They take the Catholic approach, which is ironic here with the whole Notre Dame thing, right? They take the Catholic approach where it's like, oh, well, you're just doing atonement for your sins. You still need last rites on your deathbed to be forgiven of all your sins you're going to continue to commit. Because even the act of earning money is a problem. I mean, did you see later on in the article when we're talking about these greatest hits, William, where it was like, well, they asked for $4 billion in aid for whatever crisis, and they got 2.3, which is great, but in this case with Notre Dame, they got all of what they needed at first, where they only got 2.3 out of $4 billion. What? Excuse me, if I ask for $4 million and I only get 2.3, hell, if I ask for $4 and I get $2.30, do you think I'm going to be upset about that? Very, I'm going to be like, oh, wow, very. I'm most of the way there. That was really generous of everyone that I almost got there. Like, are you kidding me right now? Are you kidding me right now? And maybe it was easier to raise money for Notre Dame because it was less money?
I don't know. I have another question, too. I don't know much about the Catholic Church and its current demographic background, but I live in California, and I think the white Catholics are a minority here. I'm just going to throw that out there.
White Catholics are a minority in France or
in California. So, I mean, worldwide.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Are we talking that...
Mexicans are super Catholic.
Yeah, is the Catholic Church a white institution?
Well, they're considering it a white institution, and I think it probably is a white institution. But again, this goes back to the whole idea of there is no whiteness that I always say. When you think of where the Catholic Church started, it's Rome, it's Italy, it's the Vatican, really, the Vatican. And, all you know, the popes have all been Italian and Polish, so it is very European and Eastern European. But again, is that fair to white people? I mean, is that fair to say Italians and Polish are the same? Because take it from someone who's Italian and Polish, they ain't the same. So yeah. that's racist and collectivist and tribalist in itself. And then, as we just said, it's spread around the world, and other cultures have adopted it as well. I mean, the Philippines are heavily Catholic. Mexico is heavily Catholic. Spain is heavily Catholic. So is it really fair to all of these cultures to say that because that's where it started, and also to simplify things into these groups in this way?
Yeah, well,
especially because Christianity in general is supposed to be about your personal relationship with God. It's just the different sects of Christianity conceptualize that relationship differently.
Well, I have a bold prediction before we move to the next story. Some fringe nut job is going to put on a yellow vest and try to relight this fire. That's my bold prediction, because of the thoughts behind this article. I'm not saying this article is causing it, but these thoughts lead to trying to relight the fire.
By the way, I love the fact that this story also subliminally has the difference between the U.S. and France in it. Whereas in the U.S., our group, we called them Antifa because we actually are creative with our names. In France, they're just like, oh, yeah, we're the yellow vest, because it's like people who do construction do yellow vests, and all blue collar people are this way. So we're just going to be like the yellow vests. Is there any wonder why the U.S. has been so great for so long?
Well, it's probably because of our next story. White privilege lecturer tells students white people dangerous if they don't see race. This comes from the College Fix in Boston. There might be a...
Of course.
Of course. During a guest lecture at Boston University on Monday, University of Washington professor Robin DiAngelo told the audience a dangerous white person sees people as individuals rather than by skin color. DiAngelo, whose main field of work is whiteness studies, added that those who say that they are taught to treat everyone the same deny black people of their reality, she said. In making the claim, DiAngelo said she was lifting the terminology from her frequent co-facilitator at speaking of engagements, black scholar Aaron Trent Johnson. DiAngelo's comments were couched during a section of her talk titled, What Does It Mean to Be White?, that discussed colorblindness and those who say, I was taught to treat everyone the same, or some version of that. If you're being honest, you've probably said it, she told the audience, and then added in that in reality, no one in the room was taught to treat everyone the same. Your parents could lecture you to do it, but you don't do it. You can't do it, and there is no human objectivity. Justin, is there human objectivity? Is this world, can we even look at this world without making some sort of computerized calculus to determine who's more privileged?
I mean, this whole article is just like a mishmash of premises, and then it leads to like absolutely absurd conclusions like you just pointed out. I mean, yes, there is a such thing as human objectivity. That's something that we believe in, and I can say we believe in very strongly in the mid-side. I mean, William, okay for me to say we right now, correct? Yep.
You can be collectivist in this sense.
Okay, I can be collectivist because that is something I just asked him about individually. I mean, look, read the quote again. What does she say right before there is no objectivity?
She says, if you're being honest, you probably said it. Your parents could lecture you to do it, but you won't do it. You can't do it. There is no human objectivity.
Right, but before that, right, what she's saying you can't do is you can't treat everyone the same.
Yeah, you can't treat everyone the same.
I agree with that premise.
Thank God you can't treat everyone the same. Wow, right. Do I treat my business partner different than I do the homeless guy that's throwing feces in everyone's direction on Olympic Boulevard. I treat those two people very differently.
Right. Here's the difference, and here are the mishmash premises that all these social justice people, these insane leftists, miss out on. The first is, when you say treat everyone the same, what you mean is everyone has a baseline respect they get from you until they prove that otherwise they don't deserve it. And that respect comes from the idea that...
Or conversely, they deserve more, right?
Well, I was going to get to that, right? I was going to get to that. Hold on.
Oh, man.
The idea is that everyone is an individual and every person has a right to his own life or her own life and can make his or her own best decisions. I'm just going to keep saying him from now on, the male, the masculine pronoun, his own decisions for his life. And you give everyone that respect where you just go around and you assume, you know what you're doing. I'm going to let you know what you're doing. And if you give me the same respect and respect my individuality and my right to life, then I'm going to respect that for you. Then as I get to know you, I am going to judge you as an individual and treat you better or worse based upon that. You know, there are going to be a lot of people that you like and you're going to treat them better based upon that and, you know, give more deference to them. Or perhaps, you know, you might say, man, I really value a certain church, so I'm going to give that more deference than I would a certain museum. It works that way for people, too. Now, that's not to say you treat people the same way as you treat a church or a museum. It just means you're judging each thing individually on its own. The difference here is people like this professor are saying, we're not judging people individually. We're judging them by their collective group they belong to. And it's whatever the in vogue collective group is. Why is it more important to judge minorities by their skin color, by any human being by their skin color, than their height, than their weight, than their gender, than their DNA composition? Why are we judging based upon that? Then their hair color, then their eye color, then how many fingers they have, then the length of their fingers. Why are we deciding based upon race? Because it's the most visually obvious right away? Is it even the most visually obvious?
I think it's great that what we're truly trying to like zone in on here is how to judge, right? That, you know, judge and prepare to be judged. We're really talking about character, and that character is an individual trait. Context matters here, right? Like most things on the mid-side, it's more nuanced than atomistic.
And when we say context matters, William, I want to make an important statement. Race does matter. And what I mean by that is how each individual deals with his or her own race, just like as they deal with his or her own gender, matters in judging them, because it matters in how they judge and conceptualize themselves.
It also matters because of the choices they make. Just like, you know, I have a body type and capabilities, and you can judge me based on how I make choices because of that, right? Like if I ate food that was bad for me all the time and was sick all the time, then... You could judge me, right? You're judging me for my choices. You're not judging me based on some group that I belong to, by just mere classification, not by my choice, right? Like I I didn't choose to be gay. So assigning a bunch of attributes to me, assigning a bunch of privileges to me because I'm gay is just nonsensical.
I just lost my train of thought with what you're going to say. But yeah, it'd be like saying you're a bad gay because you don't like show tunes, right?
Yeah. Well, I've been told stuff like that.
Well, that's exactly it. And that's collectivistic.
Yep.
So this article is just like, here's the thing I can appreciate about this article, or not appreciate, depending on how you want to look at, you know, our culture. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? It's interesting how bare they're getting with their statements. The fact that somebody would actually use an article of saying, oh, white privilege, blah, blah, blah. Oh, there is no objectivity. Oh, implicit bias. They are laying bare their philosophical premises, their ideas in a way they never have before. I think that's good because I think that means this is at the crescendo of this stuff. I mean, we've already started to see the cracks. And again, this is another example of a crack to me. They are so cocky that they think they can just throw this absurd shit out there and most people will just accept the fact that they're saying there is no objectivity, you have implicit bias, and people are just going to accept it. And the more they do that, the more people are going to, the average everyday person is going to rebel against that.
Yeah, I want to quickly, this is a thought that's been forming in my head for a while, but you know, you look at how blatantly this contradicts MLK's statement, right? You know, his statement about judging the content of people's character was an appeal to individualism, right? And if you look at how we fought racism historically and how we enfranchised, you know, minorities of all different kinds, two appeals work and are effective. The first is appeal to our commonality, not necessarily tribalism in this respect, but like, hey, we're all humans, right? And then the other is an appeal to individuality. You say, hey, each individual is, you know, is sovereign, right? You make appeals about how individual dignity and individual rights, like you appeal to a larger, a larger idea of we are all in one group. We are one group of humans, and you appeal at the same time to individuality. This destroys both, right? It's fracturing everyone into different groups, and it's undermining the very thing they're trying to do, quote unquote.
Well, that's because you know that's not what they're really trying to do. What are they really trying to do, William?
They need more, wider powers.
Right. That's all this is. It's just a way of guilting us and controlling us. That's all this is.
Yeah. Well, if you are overcome with guilt and want to, I don't know, atone for your sins and really show how woke you are, there is a new clothing line that allows men to proclaim their cucks who share their wives. T-shirts including My Husband Likes to Watch, Sissy Husband, and Married with Benefits. A new clothing line features shirts that allow men to proclaim that they are cucks who share their wives and girlfriends with other men. The Cuck in Bull Shop features dozens of designs, including a T-shirt that says Cuck, proud sponsor of a hot wife, and one for women that says My Husband Likes to Watch. Another T-shirt which says Bull appears to be mainly modeled by black men, while another, worn by a white model, says Sissy Husband. So, Justin, which of these shirts did you purchase?
None of them. None. I purchased none of these shirts.
Oh, I think this is hilarious. I mean, I guess, you know, fetishes are fetishes, but this seems a little bit unhealthy that this is becoming such a big thing.
Well, what do you mean? What's becoming such a big thing? Wearing T-shirts that say this stuff, fetish?
Yeah, wearing T-shirts about your sexual fetishes. It just seems so weird.
Well, this in particular, and I'm looking at the site right now because the article said you can buy these things, so I was interested. And it says free shipping for orders over $100. Like, who's going to buy $100 worth of these T-shirts unless one of these T-shirts is worth, like, I'm going to click on unisex T-shirts here. One of these T-shirts, how much are they charging for one? They're charging for $30. So I guess if you buy four T-shirts,
You need one for you, one for your wife, and one for your wife's boyfriend. So,
well, I think you mean your wife needs one for each of those. Because yeah. I don't think a guy is buying these, is he?
I don't know.
Regardless,
is getting into this is something to me. This just seems so such good marketing for these guys, right? Like you there's a whole group of the internet that calls people cucks all the time. So I can see this happening. See these being shipped currently to several Twitter and YouTube personalities. And also I can imagine frat hazing that these shirts would be perfect shirts for your pledges. So there you go.
Well, that's true from an ironic sort of point of view. But this is actually using the literal definition of the word cuck, correct?
Yeah.
When people are out there saying cuck in political language, they're using it abstractly. Where cuck literally means that sexually you are allowing your spouse... I don't want to make it gendered. I mean, it typically is gendered in the sense that it's a husband for a wife. But typically it's the husband lets the wife sleep around and he doesn't. Or it's not even that. It's the... I don't even want to use the word lets. She sleeps around and he doesn't and he's okay with it. I would say it that way.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about all of this, William, is I really think that this is... You know, whether this is really being used for the purpose it is, like if it's really marketing to these people... Let's suppose that it is. It's virtue signaling. It's virtue signaling through sexual preference. It's the idea of taking this anti-masculine, super obscene, super twisted modern feminist culture and virtue signaling about it. Oh, well, you wear this because this is how evolved of a man you are. And this is how evolved of a woman you are.
Well, I don't know if this is going to work, though, because I'm not sure the Asian woman wearing the China shop shirt is going to be allowed in the virtue signaling camp.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure about that
also,
either. I was going to ask you about the bull thing.
Yeah, the black guy wearing bareback warrior is also a little bit triggering to some, especially in the AIDS community. So, yeah, there's a lot of it's hard to virtue signal and not offend someone at the same time.
Yes, yes, yes. And what about the bull thing as well? How come they only have black men wearing it in the... All of these pictures are Photoshopped, by the way. There's a site where you can go and find pictures of models with blank shirts and put the text on it or the logo or whatever your graphic is. And it's very obvious if you look at the pictures.
Yeah, the pictures are obviously Photoshopped.
Right, so the models are not... They're not... The models are probably mad because they didn't want to grant sanction to this, right? They're not like saying, this is okay, we're part of this. They got paid to be part of a stock site, and now they're being used for this, which is, don't do that in the year 2019, people. I know you want the money, but don't do that. So I don't want to think the models are giving any sort of legitimacy to this. But it says something that the people who made this, either if they made it as a joke or not, why did they pick... to put the word bull only on black men shirts.
I think this is an incredibly good farce if this is a joke. I think this is great because there are people who are legit going to buy these shirts. Like there's no because they see this kind of like you know you hit the nail on the head. This kind of virtue signaling about your sexual preferences is getting way out of hand. So it's a perfect time to make fun of it.
Agreed. But you didn't answer my question.
No, I have to answer your questions. I usually leave that to Daniel.
Well, I know, but this is one I think you would know more about because, you know, we
is
already
it
saw
Dick?
It were. Right. So the whole bull thing.
Yeah.
Is that associated with race?
I think it's because...
is it the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan?
I think it is. Bull is usually for someone with a big dick. And so that's probably why they're putting on the black person because that's the stereotype.
See, there you go. There you go. I would have thought like horse was associated because, you know, that whole stereotype. But all right. I always thought it was hung like a horse. I didn't know
it
was built like a bull.
Yeah.
Although built like a bull would be like muscular, wouldn't it?
Yeah, usually.
All right. This is all weird, dude. I don't understand any of this. I just wanted to point this out because it's like, is this the point we're at?
Well,
and here's the other irony. This is through like a super quote unquote right wing, quote unquote alt right. I don't know if he's actually alt right person who posted this on his website and shared it with his followers. So the people on the other side of each other are giving amplification to the insanity on either side. It's free marketing. Like, at a certain point, like, I get that it's crazy and, like, you want the hits on your site, but it's become this incestuous cycle where in order to get hits on your site, you give their sites that you believe supposedly are evil clicks, and then you get to start wondering how much integrity does everyone actually have?
Well, don't wonder too hard because you may develop a mental health disorder. Like, this study indicates 1 in 5 children also suffer from a mental health disorder. This comes from our friends in Canada, Hamilton, Ontario. 1 in 5 children suffer from a mental disorder, with notable increases in depression and anxiety over the past 30 years. Yet less than 1/3 have had contact with a mental health care provider, a new study finds. Wait, I thought this was Canada. They have free health care. Results from the 2014 Ontario Child Health Study actually mirror findings from a similar study conducted in 1983. But this latest version shows a higher proportion of children and youth with disorders have had contact with health providers in other settings, usually via schools. The new study also found that the patterns of prevalence among different genders and age groups have changed. Specifically, hyperactivity disorders in boys between 4 and 11 years old spiked from 9% to 16%. Conversely, there was a significant decrease in disruptive behavior in boys 12 to 16, with the numbers from 10% to 3%. Researchers also found a significant increase in anxiety and depression in male and female youth. The total jumped from 9% in 1983 to 13% in 2014. So, Justin, are we getting more mental?
I'm going to sidestep the obvious Canadian joke here because this is a Canadian study. Mm-hmm. And to answer your question, the reason I included this on the episode is I think they're using mental health as a way of controlling people. If you just create more and more diseases, that means you tell us there's things that are more and more wrong with us, right? So we always talk about, or I've talked about before, this idea of social justice carries with it the idea of original sin, right? When you look at implicit bias, when you look at privilege, these are ways of smuggling the concept of original sin. And what I mean by that is, you know, I talked about this with Catholicism earlier in the episode. It's the idea that when you are born, because you're a human being, you are born naturally flawed. You will necessarily commit wrong and do bad things simply because you are a human being. And that creates the need for religion, because then you need God to forgive you, right? Because you're born with original sin and you need God to cleanse you of those sins. A different sex of Christianity, different religions approach that differently, how you're going to be forgiven. You know, with the born again Christians, they say if you just accept Jesus into your life, then you're okay because you've acknowledged that you're a sinner and you bathe in the joy of him. Whereas Catholics want you to continually atone and continually feel that guilt. And Judaism has a similar sort of guilt for existence. Social justice has been doing it with things like privilege and implicit bias. Well, now we see another arm of them doing it, right? Now they're going to convince us we all have mental health disorders. 1 in 5 kids have mental health disorders. So how did they get them? There's only two ways of saying it. Either one, they're all mistreated and they're developing these disorders because of how poorly treated they are, which again, that would make us feel guilty about how we're treating our children, which then gives them control of our children. Or we're all just born, 1 in 5 of us are born fucked up. And if we're born fucked up, then, you know, we're bad people. And we need other people to take care of us. So it's all the same stuff. It's literally all variations of the same idea that we do not know how to live our lives well. We are not healthy people. And we need other people to live our lives for us or take care of us or tell us what to do.
Yeah, there's an aspect of control and conform, right, that we know affects boys in particular. And so it's not surprising to me to see more increases in anxiety and those sort of things in boys. It's also interesting that, you know, you see the focus of the article is on these folks aren't getting treatment. So is this, you know, is this just a money grab for the healthcare, right? Like, it's like, there's nothing here that looks at, or there's not, obviously the study isn't intended to do this, but there's, in the way the article is written, there's nothing that looks at like, well, what in reality is causing these differences, right? And well, right, I guess in but it's a way also it's okay William. Because it, there's that would be speculation, but like we've got this isn't coming from in a vacuum, right? We've had been having these conversations for a while now.
Right, and this article isn't published by healthcare providers. This is a media source. If it was healthcare providers, if it was on the blog of like United Healthcare, right, or Cigna, who out here, who have you seen the commercials of Mind and Body, which by the way, I love. Like, thank you, Queen Latifah, for being like, hey, mental health is equally important with physical health. Like, I think that's actually good marketing for a healthcare company. But if like Cigna went out there and was like, one in five of you have a mental disorder, I would consider that bad marketing, and I would say it's what you're saying, that that is an issue of they're just trying to drum up business, right? It's all the whole like one in five doctors prefers or one in five dentists prefers our toothpaste. But this isn't. This is a media source. And what could the only reason they'd be publishing something like this is in the media?
For clicks?
Well, for clicks, but then also, you know, they all have their social agendas where they're trying to get control of people.
Yep. Well, I mean, maybe we can spin it as this is winning the war on a toxic masculinity. I mean, the higher anxiety and depression and suicide means there's less males. So maybe it's a victory story.
Well, I think they would say that. I don't think they would say that explicitly. But again, it's like I said, the whole idea of we can't live life well. I mean, it's the same thing with religion, right? Especially like when you look at Catholicism, they would actually say less sex is a good thing, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
So it's the same sort of idea. All right, on that note, let's move on to the Hope for Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. If you want me to come up with better transitions than the one I just did, then you should get in our Discord and feed me transitions. You fed me articles. You fed me trailers. Feed me transitions. Go to themidside.com/podcast, click on any episode, and you will have a link to join our Discord. You can also message us directly on social media, on any of the social medias, and we will get back to you and send you an invite link. So if you need a more personal invitation, reach out to us. I can't reach out to each of you individually and send you an invite link because I don't know who you are. So identify yourself, Midsiders. For the review this week, I want to do something a little differently. My parents were visiting over the last few days, so they flew cross-country from Massachusetts to California, which means they got to sit on a plane, and they got to watch movies while they sat on the plane. So my dad starts talking to me, William, and he says, what the hell is going on in that water movie? Can you guess what movie he was talking about?
I'm going to guess The Shape of Water.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I just said. I was like, The Shape of Water? And he's like, yeah. He's like, what the hell happened? Like, I'm watching that movie and I'm waiting for something to happen and nothing happened in that entire movie. Like, she's in love with that guy and, like, I'm just waiting for something. And he just, like, all weekend, like, this would just keep coming up and he would keep talking about it. He was like, I was waiting for them to like explain who this guy was or something. Like, I thought he was going to be like part of an alien race and the aliens were going to show up and this was going to be a whole thing about aliens. But you get to the end of the movie and nothing happens. And he's like, at a certain point, they're saying like, oh, he's even a god. And they never go anywhere with that. And then two other things that he talked about that really stuck out to me. One, apparently, you know, in the scene in the trailer where they're in the hotel room together in the bed.
Okay.
Yeah, well, like, so she frees the creature and they go to the hotel room together to escape.
Okay.
Well, apparently, what she does, because, you know, he has to live in water, she puts towels under the door and then she runs the water in the room until the room fills up.
Oh, that's how that works.
That's what my parents were talking about. Like, you know me, like, I'm not about, like, realism in movies. And I don't think they really are either, because, you know, as my dad would say, he wanted aliens in this movie, right? So my dad's like not all about realism. But when my parents are sitting there talking about how stupid it was because the water would never stay in the room, you know you've broken too far from reality. You need some element of the rules of reality in there. And then the other thing they talked about was like, well, what did happen in the end? Apparently what happens is this woman dies. And then the monster brings her back, or the sea creature. I'm sorry, we can't call it a monster.
Yeah, that's right.
Because that's the point we're humanizing this. Which I also just spoiled my punchline here, but whatever. The sea creature, apparently, she dies, and the sea creature brings her back to life underwater so they can be together and be in love, and that's the end of the movie.
Okay, that sounds like a great plot, man.
Well, that's what happened. My dad's telling me all this. He's ranting all weekend. And I go, you know, Dad, that won the Oscar for Best Director. And he's like, what the hell? Why did this win awards? And I go, why do you think? What happens in this movie? And he goes, she falls in love with the monster. I go, you got it. And the director is Mexican. And he goes, oh, okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, midsiders out there, ladies, gentlemen, and others. Sorry, I don't want to. I wouldn't be offensive.
That's true.
What we say on this show is true. We do not have to watch these movies. We can figure it out from the trailer. Again, as we were just talking about with the white privilege article earlier, this stuff is laid pretty bare nowadays, isn't it, William?
You know, we can tell almost. I wonder, we should go back and do like an accuracy rating for some of our calls. I think we've been pretty good about spotting it. Sometimes we get obfuscated by a particularly good trailer cutter, but we're usually pretty good about figuring out which ones bring in the social justice or go full naturalism.
Yes, especially when they win Academy Awards in that way.
Yeah, I can't. I wonder what the Rotten Tomato is now. I mean, like audience versus. Versus critics on that one, it's got to be a terrible ratio. How can you keep an audience locked in and interested when nothing happens?
Well, I hate to break it to you, the audience score is 73% on Rotten Tomatoes.
And what's the critic score?
92%.
There you go. That's the kind of ratio I would expect.
It is a big difference, but something that's also interesting here is, have we ever looked at the number of user ratings? Because the user ratings for Shape of Water has about 25,000, which makes me wonder. I'm just looking at Batman versus Superman Rotten Tomatoes. I want to see how many people reviewed that user ratings. Yeah, 23,000. So there's also a problem with the user ratings on Rotten Tomatoes, where there's a self-selected audience. You know, the people who are going to go and see Shape of Water and then review it on Rotten Tomatoes are more likely to give it a higher score. I wonder what the actual score of you audience who saw Shape of Water think, because how many people like my dad didn't give it a review at all? And aren't do you think my dad knows what Rotten Tomatoes is?
No, probably not.
Right.
He probably thinks it's some sort of newfangled restaurant, like hipster restaurant.
I mean, all right, exactly. So let's look at, for instance, like, I'm just going to click on Breakthrough, which has 64%. Yeah, so Breakthrough has 64%, right? That super, super religious movie about the kid who gets trapped under the ice. 64% critics with only 45 reviews. 77% audience, but only 251 reviews.
Wow.
So even the system, Rotten Tomatoes is just fucking broken, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty broken.
Shazam, 88% audience score, about 8,000 reviews.
Wow.
You can't judge these. Okay, Us, let's look at this. How about this? Us, 66% of the audience liked it, 7,000 reviews. How can you even take any of this seriously? Rotten Tomatoes is broken. It's done. Our whole idea of the algorithm with the audience score versus the critic score, we can't even do that anymore.
Yeah, you know, Netflix used to let you rate things with 5 stars, and they got it pretty good. They got better at their recommendation engine, And
yeah, but then people
like that,
shit on Amy Schumer, so they stopped doing that.
Exactly. Then they got political with it, and so they've backed down. And that's unfortunate, because there is something to be said about finding people with similar tastes and then helping navigate them through other content they like. But this whole herd mentality it can quickly devolve into two things: the lowest common denominator, and then whatever is politically connected, right? And Rotten Tomatoes is exactly that. You have whatever's politically connected in the reviewer score, and you have the herd lowest common denominator with the audience score.
Well, and that's my same problem with Yelp, to sort of just put a fine, button on this. My problem with Yelp is, how are you going to know any of these highly rated restaurants fit your individual preferences, or is it just whatever the popular gastropub hipster type place is nowadays that has the 5 stars?
Yeah.
So I agree with what you're saying, William. I think the rating systems and these way of finding what you like has to be more sort of like the way advertisements work. And what I mean by that is like, you're talking about Nintendo Switch, and then you go on Twitter and a Nintendo Switch a Nintendo Switch advertisement pops up in promoted tweets. Or because of what you search for on eBay, certain advertisements come up on your Facebook feed. It's going to have to start being that with like what you referred to as like users who have similar profiles to you, just by how they click and do things without when they think no one's watching. That data is used to inform rather than you going out and seeing what the 5-star reviews are, because there's too much of a what people think is cool, and there's too much of a lowest common denominator when you're looking at what the aggregate does.
Yeah,
it doesn't apply to you individually.
Can you imagine being a reviewer and this has to, like, I couldn't do this, and having your review be exactly the same as thousands of other published reviewers, right? Like, your take being exactly the same. Like, it would be great if it, what you do when you're judging like any expert in anything is you find someone that is, in art, I'm speaking here, you find someone who has similar tastes, and then you listen to their recommendations. But we've got a bunch of NPC clones, right, when it comes to movie reviews. They all sort of say the same thing, analyze it in the same way. They've all got this Marxist intersectionalist like lens they review every movie in. They all are very naturalistic in their tastes and love those sort of art mood pieces like The Shape of Water. It's hard to find a good reviewer other than the Midside to help guide you to find good art.
Well, and the other thing a good reviewer should do, William, is it should be more than finding someone who has the same taste as you. It should be finding someone who is objective enough, because yes, art can be objective. Art is objective. That even if it isn't your taste, you can say, oh, I may not like this, but Daniel would like it more, or William would like it more. Yep. That's important as a reviewer to be able to do. And you can be able to find reviewers who may not have the same taste as you, but are objective enough that you can say, oh, I would like this even if this person didn't like it, because they can acknowledge the difference between well-made, well-crafted, and personal preference. It's sort of like, oh, well, I don't really like fish, but I can say that that's a really well-made fish dish.
Fish dish.
All right, let's move on here. Let's talk about some stuff that will be coming up. Let's see if we can be accurate. I think we can be accurate with the first one. Accurate with these trailers that are coming out here. And as always, I post the trailers on Saturdays on themidside.com, themidside.com/podcast. Either of those, you will find the trailers. And that way you can watch them ahead of the episode. You can watch them after the episode. You can watch them during the episode. We can talk about a trailer, you watch it, or you can watch a trailer and then we talk about it.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Skin is a movie that was previously a documentary. I don't know if the documentary was called Skin, but it's about a real life story inspired by a real life story of a guy who was a skinhead and then starts to get his tattoos removed and everything because he stops agreeing with the skinhead stuff because, I don't know, the trailer made it seem like he was like brainwashed into this. Oh, this to me seems like a cross between Best of Enemies, which I saw a couple weeks ago, and also American History X. This seems to, again, be coming out at a time where people want us to believe there are so many Nazis and skinheads in this culture. So they're going to keep pushing this messaging to make us believe it. If they inundate us with this fiction, then we'll start to believe our reality is this way. And more than that, the idea of you're in a group that's full of hate and treats people collectivistically and you learn how to be an individual has some appeal to it. But it doesn't look like it's done that way. It's looked like it's done from one collective to another. And also, this looks incredibly naturalistic. Tackle.
Yeah, what a great waste of a good story. I guess, like, a documentary for this would be interesting, right? So I think it's great that there's a... You said it was based on a documentary. But there's no... In the trailer, there's nothing to really say why he's leaving the cult. It's sort of like he met a girl. He met a fat chick, so he leaves the cult. I don't get it. But maybe that's the point. I don't know. Nothing here seems dramatic other than it's dealing with touchy subjects, quote unquote. You know, like very political subjects. So yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant this was the Me Too movement, touchy subjects.
Oh yeah, no, that's different. And is this made by DirecTV? Why is there a DirecTV ad throughout the entire trailer? I don't know, but I'm gonna tackle.
Second trailer.
Child's Play is the reboot remake of the horror classic. I don't know. I mean, there was the horror franchise at least. I guess it's a classic franchise. I don't know. Fair warning, I've never been a fan of the Child's Play series. Like, the idea of, oh my god, this doll is evil, it's gonna kill me. Like, I never found that particularly creative or scary. But I don't think that matters with this trailer, okay? So, this trailer, I really have no idea what the fuck is going on. This kid needs friends or something, and then they get, like, a smart home, which is named Buddy, but then the doll interfaces with the smart home, and even though Buddy is written on the doll's genes, they start calling him Chucky, and then they think he's going around killing people or something. This trailer is basically incoherent to me. I feel like there's nothing this trailer trades on except nostalgia for the original. It's like, oh, the original is good, and this is a remake, so I'm gonna watch this one. This is a hard tackle for me.
Tackle?
Didn't say I was angry, but okay.
Well, I don't have hard tackle. But it wasn't quite Balrog levels of anger. So,
Midsider Daniel, maybe we need another read out there, Midsider Dan.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of horror in general. I do like suspense horror. This doesn't seem like that. This seems like they're going full nostalgia, full 80s slasher movie. Unless they're bringing back drive-in movie theaters, I don't think this would have any value whatsoever. So I'm going to tackle.
Tackle.
But the trailer itself was incoherent, right?
I couldn't tell what the plot was other than it messes with electronic devices. That's the only takeaway.
Right, and you can't tell who the characters are or anything, except there's a little kid who has no friends.
And no one believes.
Right.
Because that's required.
Incoherent.
Final trailer.
Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw, a.k.a. Fast and Furious presents The Rock and Jason Statham. Do you need to hear anything else? Do you need to hear anything else? So this is, I don't really know the context of this. I don't know. I haven't seen any of the Fast and Furious, so I don't know where this fits into the series. I do know that The Rock says if something endangers the world, it's his business. And I do know that him and Jason Statham are fighting an evil Idris Elba, who's like genetically enhanced. And then he has to go back to Samoa to get Roman Reigns and the Usos and other Samoans. Those are the only three from the WWE though. And there is no reason for me not to see this movie. This is a super excited hug for me.
Hug.
There's explosions, there's gunplay, and there's Jason. I am definitely in for this. This looks like a fun summer movie. I'm assuming it's coming out in the summer because it just fits that. And wow, The Fast and Furious. I remember making fun of these movies. They're enjoyable in the popcorn sort of way. I remember making fun of these movies. I think it was Fast and Furious 2 or 3 way back in the day. And man, this franchise just keeps on going, keeps on paying. So yeah, definitely hugging.
Hug.
Well, it was funny in the beginning because the first one was called The Fast and the Furious, and you never thought there'd be a sequel. And then they called the second one Fast and Furious, didn't they? Or yeah. No, that was the third one or something.
Yeah, I don't remember how that broke down, but I kept calling it Faster and Furiouser.
Right, so the titles were ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then it got to a certain point that it was like, there's seven of them, and these are banking like $2 billion. Like, it was undeniable. And then they brought The Rock and Idris Elba in, and you're like, okay. And Helen Mirren was in one, and you're just like, okay, I can't get mad at this franchise anymore. You know, I can't make fun of it.
Dustin, after it didn't make the cut for this show, but after what they're planning on doing with the James Bond series, like, is this the only action like genre that we have left? Is Fast and Furious?
Pretty much. I can't really think of another one. I mean, unless they make that rumored sixth Die Hard film.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
So we'll see. Good points. Let's move on now to a William-centric Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. William, I know that you've been working hard on getting Jersey Mike's relaunched or something.
Yep, getting our relocation completed.
Relocation completed. And you told me you had some interesting reflections during that experience recently, so I want to hear all about that.
Yeah, so little context without going into too much detail. So the store 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago now, we received notice that the building that we were in was kicking everyone out. They were going to put a 24-hour fitness in. All the retail, there was like five retail things in that area that were all going to get kicked out. And so we had about 3 months to pack up our shit and leave. And so it's taken 2 years to find a place, you know, deal with the bank and get all the city planning and the building shell all constructed. And so we're in the middle of construction. We're going to be opening real soon now, TM. And this has been, it's been a lot of work. The thing that I wanted to share is not that, oh, I'm doing a lot of work. It's that I've noticed that the more things I'm doing, as long as I'm smart about it, which I'll get into, the more things I can actually do. And it's become kind of a virtuous cycle. Like, people ask me, like, how are you able to do this? You're working full time and you're doing all this stuff, you know, to prepare for the store. And I think that, I've found myself more motivated as I'm getting closer to this, you know, looming deadline, and more energized because I have more things to do. And I remember being in college when I was working two jobs and going to school full time, and I was just sort of in the zone. And one thing that I learned in college, and I didn't make the mistake now that it's crunch time in this part of my life, is for a while there, I did not sleep well. I did not work out. I wasn't eating well, and I would come off the rails really easily. And now I think because I'm a little bit more mature and a little bit more disciplined, and I have, like, you know, I'm really good about keeping things in my, I use a task manager, OmniFocus, to like really make sure I remember things. It's great to just, you know, to get up in the morning, relax, have my coffee, check what I got to do today, and then just start punching down the list. And it's so rewarding. It's so rewarding I wish I had that knowledge back in college, right? Of like how to actually set time for myself to relax and then have it so that when I'm energized, I can just dive right in. So I don't really think it's like a question, but it's more just this reflection on, wow, I'm busier now than I've ever been, busier, quote unquote, but I'm getting more things done than I've ever really done in my life. And I just wanted to offer that advice.
Well, William, I think there's an interesting suppressed premise in something you're saying. And it was in the beginning of what you said, where you said people ask you about how you're so busy, like, how do you do it all? And how are you still, you know, energetic, and how are you still passionate about it? When you're describing to me, and even what you just said, what you've been doing, I hear that you have momentum. And what I mean by that is the work you're doing makes it easier for you to streamline and then get other work and continue to be, get other work done and continue to be more productive. Now, you're living in California, which is going to kind of undermine my point a little bit. But the one of the problems I have, and one of the reasons I want to leave California, is I work really hard, right? I have two jobs. I have a full-time job. I have a part-time job. I do my podcasts. You know, I write stuff. I work on, you know, I'm working on a video series right now. And I also go to the gym 5 days a week. Plus, I have a girlfriend. But I feel like I have no forward momentum. I feel like the system right now, the economy most specifically, is set up in a way that I can't get ahead, that I'm doing all of this work just to have the life that I have. It's not building. Whereas when I hear what you're saying, you're describing it in a way that you figured out how to do work to increase your productivity rather than keep your productivity to the same way. And I think that's an important distinction here. It's not just hard work. It's hard work in a way that enables you to do more in the time, the same amount of time.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really, I've had to think about and really challenge the limits, or what people think are the limits, right? You know, like, I'm taking on more responsibility at my full-time job as well. And so far, I think I've kind of like surprised people. Like, they've been very supportive. They know the store's coming. So there's going to be a couple weeks there where I'm completely disconnected from my full-time job. But I think I've sort of proven that I can handle more responsibility despite like this whole development process. I mean, I, you know, it's once you start to build that momentum, even if it's small, it starts to snowball. And I think that's a really important point.
How do you think that you're able to do that in California, whereas me personally, I'm finding that extremely difficult?
Oh, I think that's hard. I mean, it is. I'm glossing over a lot of the difficulty, I think. You know, like, I could talk forever about the difficulties of getting a high-rise building to do anything in California, because it's difficult for them because of the city regulations. Like, even just like we posted on Discord, the sign going up, I can only have one sign. I can't have the sign on both streets because we're on a corner. I can't have the sign on both streets because of the city. And like, maybe that can get resolved in like a year. So maybe within a year I'll have two signs. Like, heaven forbid we have two signs. So many people you have to bribe in order to get two signs. But you know, there's tons of like little things like that add up. I mean, it shouldn't have taken us 2 years to do this, right? Like, I could be very negative about it and say like, wow, 2 years, this is taking way too long. And you know, there's a ton of extra cost because of the delays, and you know, I could get very negative about it, but I think it's seeing the bigger picture. You know, I don't know where everything's going to end up, but I'm kind of rowing in the right direction, and that's what matters. So that's what I keep reminding myself.
Okay. That's all great. I love that. Although, is there a suppressed premise in there that I'm too negative? Is that what you were saying?
I was thinking only about me, but maybe that's the California narcissism. But yeah, I think, you know, I mean, you've talked about, you know, moving out of California and that, you know, taking an opportunity somewhere else. And I think that that could be your, you know, the beginning of your momentum. It really just depends on it depends on your outlook and owning the things you can control, which is super important, and not really, you know, just dealing with the things that you can't control. Like, I can't control the fact that we expedited our permits from the city only to have the buildings, you know, the building's permits delayed for months, right? Like, you know, that's $6,000 I can't get back. But, you know, like, but I can't control it, right? So I can't really do anything about it. I can just do what I can do and own the choices and decisions I can make and own the circumstances I can change.
Right, 100%. But I think there is an important distinction I want to make here. And I would say that I think you, at a base level, have a skill set and career in one of the few industries that actually is thriving and successful in California still.
Fast food?
Well, I was referring to your technical job.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. I would not be in California if it were not for the opportunity here on my engineering side. I wouldn't have chosen California, but that right, opportunity so, is here. So right. I think that goes back to what you were saying. Like wherever you find opportunity, obviously California is not it right now. Orange County is not the land of opportunity for your talent and skill set. So there are, you know, setting the stage correctly is important. I mean, I wasn't happy in Baltimore. I had a good job, but I wasn't happy there.
Exactly. And I think that is the first sort of step in this process that you're talking about, where you're not just working, you're working and building momentum and you're increasing your productivity with the amount of work you do. Because it, you know, in Massachusetts, it's a lot of just put in more work and it's not about being productive. But I think you've teased out an interesting thing about being working harder and being more productive with that work. Yeah. And I think that starts with when you work harder at making sure you're maximizing the context you're in order for your efforts to be most rewarded productively.
Yeah.
That's a great way to end this episode. What did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that there are just so many sexual fetishes that I need to be printing on t-shirts, and I need to seize this opportunity quickly and put them up on the Midside store before we decide that you can no longer virtue signal about your sexuality. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
I learned from Trailer Takedown what you said, that pretty much The Rock is one of the few good things we have left in action movies, if not the only good thing we have in action movies. I guess we'll see what Zack Snyder does with Army of the Dead. Otherwise, action movies aren't looking too great nowadays.
Oh, man. I'm just imagining The Rock as James Bond.
Yeah. So do you want to plug it all, or you just want to go into the end of the episode here?
Oh, well, don't forget to follow us on the social medias. Make sure you check out themidside.com /podcast or /store. See, we've got some cool shit up there. Also, make sure you share the episode, give us a 5-star rating. We love those, and we'll see you next time.
This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin Emelzneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day. Is it offensive to have lamb on Easter?
Ooh. That's interesting. I never thought of that before.